Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The tradition of modern medicine, one focused largely on surgeries and pills, has saved untold millions of lives. But for the millions who battle chronic pain, who struggle to sleep, and with many other ailments, the answer may be a whole lot less modern, but not less traditional. Although Chinese herbal therapy has been around for a couple millennia, Western medical practitioners have largely ignored it. Now, the world-famous Cleveland Clinic offers Chinese herbal medicine therapies at its hospital. Joining us now by phone from Cleveland is the clinic's chief herbalist, Galina Rufiner. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, everybody.
So can we talk briefly about the different philosophies between Western medicine and what you're talking about today, Chinese herbal therapy or Chinese herbal medicine?
Usually, Western medicine approach is to quick, immediate fix. In traditional Chinese herbal therapy, we can have both approaches dependent on necessity of the patient. We can address acute issues, but we also are really good at managing chronic issues with much safer way, much gentler way, with much less side effects. And which is the most important, we are greatly compatible with Western treatment.
How did you or whoever convince the Cleveland Clinic to take on a Chinese herbal therapy clinic?
It's not the secret that United States model of healthcare is very technologically advanced. It's the most expensive in the world, but it's not the best in addressing all of the plethora of the health issues of the patients. And then we're talking about cost effectiveness, amount of side effects. We start looking at established traditional therapies which have been practiced for over millennia all over the world. And even if we look at modern Western medication, we tend to forget the fact that over 50% of modern medical drugs are still plant-derived. So in Chinese herbal therapy, over thousands of years, we have an experience of handling chronic issues in a gentle manner.
How is it being received so far? How long have you been open and for business, and how is it being received?
We opened very recently. We opened our doors in January due to the simple fact that Ohio legislators just last year passed the law that we are permitted to practice Chinese herbal medicine in state of Ohio.
Okay.
So in United States, it has been practiced for a few decades in different states.
And who might seek out herbal treatments? Do you work with other physicians, or do you who refer patients to you, or are patients coming to you directly?
Absolutely. At the beginning of our clinic, for the first year of the existence, we do require physician referral. It's maybe referral from your physician, independent, it's a general practice or specialty physician, or it's maybe one of our physicians in our integrative medicine department. After 1 year, that provision will be lifted, but for right now, we exercise additional caution. As well, our patients on herbal therapy are routinely monitored with the series of the tests during herbal treatment at the first month of the treatment, 3 months and 6 months. We do draw the labs to make sure that it's safe and compatible with your medications.
My guest is Galina Rufiner. She's chief herbalist at the Cleveland Clinic, which offers Chinese herbal medicine therapies. If you have a question or comment for Galina Rufiner, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We've talked about herbal medicines before on the show, and the criticism, and I always get it, has always been that there isn't enough or often in some people's opinions, any reliable, legitimate research on herbal therapies.
Oh, there are tons of research. Anyone can access Medline, and if you just type the name of the disease and Chinese herbal therapy, you will see lots and lots of research. So yes, this is true. Majority of the research is done in China, Taiwan, Japan, because like in Taiwan and Japan, herbal therapy is paid by the government, by major insurance companies. So they have herbal therapy offered in the hospitals, which definitely opens the opportunity for a lot of research. In United States, because it has not been offered in the hospitals previously, we are kind of slow on research opportunities. But there, nevertheless, are plenty of research.
Now, as you mentioned that you monitor and you have a schedule of monitoring the therapies and their effectiveness and so forth, are any of the patients, are you going to be involved in research in the United States on herbal therapies?
So far, it's all in the air. It just depends how well we will be able to obtain the grants for research and so forth, since research is pretty expensive to conduct. But it is in the plans, yes.
What makes something an herb versus a conventional drug, clinically speaking? They're all supposed to fix an illness. What's the distinction?
It all depends on individual issue, and we have an acute diseases. Like, for example, acute pneumonia probably is more cost-efficient and effective just to treat with antibiotics. Mm-hmm. But if we are looking to some type of chronic diseases, like, for example, fibromyalgia, there is not that many of very effective medications which would have a very minimal amount of side effects. In this particular case scenario, Chinese herbal therapy has better benefits. Or let's say then we need to regulate immune system for the people who have allergies or propensity to catch cold or to restore after cancer therapy. That's where Chinese herbal therapy is a superior therapy.
Galina Rufiner, are you a physician too, or?
No, okay. I'm not an MD. I'm licensed Oriental Medicine practitioner in state of Ohio. That is the official title. Our education, though, is rather quite extensive. We do have to have just a regular 4 years of prerequisite, like for any medical school. And our Oriental medicine school is also 5 academic years, which you can accomplish in 4 calendar years. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's still a lot of education. And then we study two-thirds of Oriental medicine and one-third of Western medicine. So we are pretty well-versed.
How is the dosing determined with herbs? Are they as predictable as conventional drugs?
To some degree, yes, because definitely general dosing guidelines do apply according to the weight of the patient, according to the age of the patient, according to severity of the disease of the patient. Yes, absolutely.
Let's get a question in here. Jim in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hey, I just had a question from your guest there about what would be good to help control or lower blood pressure and just all out make you feel good, give your body a boost. I don't like taking all these prescriptions, you know? So, and I'll take my answer off the air if I could.
I can hear
you better.
Okay, Jim. Thanks.
It all depends on what is the reason for your blood pressure, because in traditional Chinese medicine, we do not treat a Western medical diagnosis. We treat the patient. But even if we look at Western medicine, we have, on average, 3 different types of medications which may be administered. It may be diuretic. It may be medication which affects tension of your blood pressure. It may be the medication which affects cardiac output. The same in traditional Chinese medicine. Until I see the patient and I know what is the reason for blood pressure, that's when we can talk a little bit more about specific herbal therapy.
Do people equate safety and herbal treatments? Is this Is that a good way to approach it, or not necessarily? Can herbal treatments be harmful?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Absolutely not necessarily. Natural does not mean safe in any meaning. If we look even like at such a Western medication like digoxin, which is made from the foxglove, it's extremely poisonous plant.
Mm-hmm.
So not safe at all. It's also not safe to buy herbal products in China market or something like that. There are issues of contamination with herbicides, pesticides, heavy metal, Western pharmaceuticals. It's why in Cleveland Clinic we spend a lot of time researching the best suppliers in the world. We use products made at KPC, which stands for Kaiser Pharmaceuticals Company. It's made in Taiwan. And Taiwan has the highest international standards as of today. All of the products are triple tested by the factory, by international independent experts, and by independent experts and FDA here in the United States for all of the contamination and all other issues. Also, for our compounding prescriptions, we utilize Crane Herb Pharmacy located in Massachusetts, which actually was set by FDA expert in full accordance with federal guidelines, for we would be sure that our herbs do not possess any possible danger for the patient beside correctness of the prescription.
Angelo in Columbus, you have a question for Galina Rufiner?
Oh, yes. Good morning. Thanks for having me. My question is this. I am a professional licensed in Italy in herbal science, and I was wondering with my degree if there is an opportunity to, you know, in this field here in the United States, because I've been studied phytotherapies and its effects also in the public hospitals, but my country is not really developed yet this kind of practice in the public hospitals.
I guess generally what Angela is asking is this a growing field, Galina Rufiner? Are there places where you can get a job doing this?
Yes, definitely. It is a growing field, and if 40 years ago acupuncture was illegal in the United States, today we are in major hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the states, like, for example, Florida, we do have essentially the same rights as the primary care. It is a growing field, and you do need to have a certain standards of education. You do need to pass very vigorous examinations. You have to have national certifications in acupuncture or Chinese herbal therapy, which requires a certain number of education.
Mm-hmm.
We are licensed by the state, which requires vigorous exams to be passed. So better to find out requirements in each state is to contact a local state health department, which will have all of those requirements lined up.
Thank you, Angelo, for that call. Just one last question. I mentioned earlier that I always, you know, after I do a show on herbal medicines, the critic will emerge, and I fully expect it with this one. You must work in a hospital with people who very much disagree with the clinic being located there.
You know, like everywhere else, there are proponents and opponents. It depends on our belief system,
mm-hmm.
on our prior education. But in majority of the cases, which I see, there is not enough information available for mm-hmm. people, and many of them just don't take enough job to educate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, Chinese way of diagnosing uses completely different
mm-hmm.
system. It's why it's very difficult to comprehend for Western mind.
Mm-hmm.
Also, due to FDA regulations, on any type of supplements or herbal therapy, we are prohibited to claim that we can treat any of the Western medical diseases. And in reality, we do not. I do not treat an arthritis.
Gotcha.
I do treat a knee pain.
Okay. Interesting. So. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been very nice talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for an invitation. Enjoy it a lot.
Galena Rufiner, she's the chief herbalist at the brand new Cleveland Clinic, which opened in January, where they offer Chinese herbal medicine therapies. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. This Saturday is National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day, when you can dispose of old pills at designated sites. You can't exactly take them back to where you received them. You have to take them to designated sites. So take a quick look through the average medicine cabinet, maybe the one in your home. Most folks are likely to find a health history spelled out in medicine. There's the cough syrup from that winter cold, the diet pills that failed again, those painkillers from back surgery 3 years ago. You might not be taking them anymore, but the problem is someone else might, and flushing them down the toilet is not the answer. Bad. Joining us now by phone is the Ohio Department of Health Injury Prevention Program Administrator, Christy Beagley. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thank you.
And joining us in the studio from the City of Columbus Sewage and Drainage is Jeff Bertacci. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thank you.
Christy, what harm are the prescriptions doing if they're just sitting in our cabinets?
Well, the problem is that oftentimes they're not just sitting in the cabinets, and other folks are getting their hands on them. So if you have children or teenagers in your home, it's very likely that they could be curious about those medications and they could fall into the wrong hands. We know that about two-thirds of people that get prescription painkillers for non-medical use are getting those from friends and family members in some way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, you know, we're experiencing a prescription opioid overdose epidemic. So we know that these medications can very much lead to very tragic consequences down the road.
Is there any ramification from people using, for medicinal purposes perhaps, but expired prescriptions? That happens sometimes. I have not done it, but I've looked through my medicine cabinet and I found old prescriptions from 3 and 4 years ago. And I'm wondering, sometimes people think, oh, I'll just pop one of these pills that helped my back 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, you know, medications do have expiration dates and they can lose their effectiveness over time. That's something that definitely varies per the medication. So it'd be important to talk to your doctor and your pharmacist about that before before you'd want to take medications that have expired.
Why can't we just take our drugs, our prescribed drugs, back to the pharmacy we get them from? Why can't they just take them back, like recycling cans and bottles? Well, they don't do that in Ohio either, actually.
That's a great question, and it certainly seems like a very logical solution. Unfortunately, by law, the pharmacies can't accept those medications back. Except under very specific circumstances, if they haven't left the building. But pharmacies in Ohio really can't take the drugs back. So especially controlled substances, law enforcement have to be involved in the chain of custody. So that's one of the reasons we can't take them back to pharmacies at this time.
Jeff Bertacci, what happens when you flush your pills down the toilet?
In many cases, the system that you're flushing to, the wastewater treatment plants, are not equipped with the technology or the methods to fully remove those compounds from the wastewater. So they end up reaching the receiving stream, in our case, the Scioto-Olentangy River watershed, where they're then taken up by water plants who also don't have the necessary treatment to remove those, and they get right back into the drinking water. in the atmosphere, in the environment, they can impact animals. Most of these drugs are some form of a hormone. So they interrupt the normal processes in the animals and cause mutations of cells and different effects on them also.
Do we have any sense about how much of our water is affected in this way?
The EPA is doing ongoing studies. At the moment, they conclude that most of our waterways do have chemicals in them of concern. Everything from birth control pills to caffeine that we might drink that passes through our systems unaffected and then reaches the wastewater systems and is passed through.
So what happens? So there's Christy, there's going to be this take back day on Saturday, drug take back day. What do people do with the drugs?
Basically, they just drop them off. There will be stations, and they'll direct people. It's sort of a no questions asked setup, and they can just drop off typically over the counter as well as prescription medications. It's a very simple, easy process. There's a website. The DEA has organized all of this across the country, and there's a website where people can go and find the drop-off locations nearest to them.
And when you're dropping it off, do they want it in the original containers, or can you just give them a bag of pills?
That's a great question. I think, you know, really whatever people are most comfortable doing. When we recommend that people dispose of their medications at home, we suggest that they don't leave them in the original bottles with the labels on them.
Mm-hmm.
What we would suggest is that they dump the medication into a bag that contains something undesirable like kitty litter or coffee grounds, and then they would seal the bag and dispose of it and dispose of the pill bottle separately with the labels removed.
Jeff Bertacci, I know you're with the Department of Public Utilities in the city of Columbus, but is there any danger to the landfills if we fill them up with pills?
There is a danger. It's under study, of course, by the EPA. There's ongoing studies, as I've said. But landfills create what we call leachate, and that's the process of rainwater that gets into the landfill and it flows down through the garbage. That leachate is collected and treated and released, but there again, certain chemicals don't break down under conventional treatment that a landfill might have, or if the landfill discharges that water to the POTW, in our case, the city, again, that's entering our system.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. I'm talking right now with Christy Beegley. She's the administrator for the Ohio Department of Health Injury Prevention Program, and also Jeffrey Bertacci. We're talking about from the City of Columbus Department of Public Utilities, and we're talking about what to do with your drugs, you know, your prescription drugs you have sitting around in your closet, and off the over-the-counter drugs that you have sitting around in your medicine cabinet, in your closets, under the counter, that sort of thing, that have just been sitting there. What do you do with them? On Saturday, it's Drug Take Back Day. The Ohio EPA has been advertising it. You can go to the website that we'll have on our website at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides and learn where drop-off points are in your neighborhood. Christy, why do we have to have a certain day in the year? Why isn't there just a place you can bring these things all the time?
Well, I think having a day is a great way to raise awareness about the issue of prescription drug abuse and overdose. It's a great way to educate people about the dangers of having, keeping excess medications in your home and keeping them unsecured. But there are locations where people can take back their medications. We have permanent drug drop boxes all over the state of Ohio.
Hmm.
The National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators has a program where they work with local law enforcement agencies, and the law enforcement agencies house these boxes. And I can give you a website where
sure.
people can go and find a drug drop box closest to them in their community. The Department of Health worked with the Ohio Attorney General's Office and the Drug-Free Action Alliance in 2012, and we helped place over 60 of these boxes in 23 southern Ohio counties. But I know that there's many more all over the state of Ohio at this point.
If you have a question or comment for the guests, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned most of them or all of them are down in southern Ohio. That is where the biggest drug abuse problem is in Ohio still?
Yes, we've definitely seen higher rates of drug overdose in southern Ohio, but the issue has spread across the state. And there are locations where people can dispose of their drugs safely all over the state now.
We know that heroin abuse is getting a lot of publicity in Ohio. How does that compare with the prescription drug abuse issue?
Well, you know, we believe that the two are very related to each other. They have a parallel course. What we just released, overdose statistics for 2012, fatal overdose statistics, and we have seen a pretty dramatic shift where prescription opioid deaths have tapered off to some extent, whereas the heroin deaths have increased quite dramatically from 2011 to 2012. But we know that these two issues are very much related, and many people, you know, won't wake up one day and say, I'm going to go out and try heroin. They were introduced to opioids, which are heroin and prescription pain medications are both opioids. They're chemically related. They're basically cousins, and they have the same impact on the brain. So when people are, exposed to the prescription medications and then they develop a tolerance and perhaps addiction to them, heroin then can become an acceptable substitute down the road as their addiction progresses, unfortunately.
Jeff Bertacci, in the work that you do, cleaning the water before we drink it again, are there ways to filter, or are they devising? Is someone out there trying to work on ways to filter out these kinds of elements from the water?
There are several technologies that are being developed. Some already exist. The problem with these technologies is their cost. Very, very expensive, cost prohibitive in some cases. Larger municipalities like ourselves might have the means to do it. Smaller municipalities would be very hard pressed to put these technologies in place.
And of course, then even still, there's the exposure to the wild.
That's correct. There is exposure. These things are in the environment and will persist in the environment for quite a while.
Are there other things that people can do besides disposing of their pills, their drugs properly, like where they wash their car, anything else that you can suggest to people about how to keep these chemicals out of the water?
The main thing is just exactly that. Be aware of your surroundings and the activities that you're in. Make sure that you're not putting dirty waters down the storm drains. We have a program where we've marked our storm drains, no dumping, no oils, no gases. We have a section that investigates incidences of illicit dumping. We ask that you don't flush any chemicals down the drains, obviously. That includes your household drugs and whatnot that you take. There are proper disposal methods for those.
And Christy Beagley, you said they're taking all drugs, over-the-counter, anything you have that you aren't using right now.
Typically, that's the case. Some locations have specific rules. Like some of them may not want to take liquids, but that would be determined by each of the sites. What I would do is go to the website and check the different locations. They'll usually have contact information.
Have you done this? Has there been a drug take-back day before?
Yes. The DEA coordinates drug take-back days annually.
Uh-huh.
So there's been many of these. And local communities have also done their own as well. But because law enforcement has to be involved and they have to receive a special waiver from the DEA. The DEA helps coordinate these annual days to really facilitate the process and make it easy for communities to participate.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have those links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Jeff Bertacci, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Bertacci, he is from the City of Columbus Sewage and Drainage. That's in the Department of Public Utilities. And Christy Beagley, thank you as well for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Christy Beagley is the administrator for the Ohio Department of Health Injury Prevention Program. Wellness Wednesday will continue on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Anybody who gave up sweets for Lent probably felt some relief on Easter Sunday when they could finally dig into that bag of jelly beans they'd been saving for the kids. But if you thought that 40 days was a long time to deprive yourself of a particular confection, imagine 365 days or 300 days would be like without any added sugar at all. One Vermont author tried such an experiment, swearing herself and her family off sugar for an entire year. She writes about it in a new book called, appropriately, Year of No Sugar. Welcome to the show, Eve Schaub.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
The word sugar covers a lot of ground. Can you define what you meant by sugar for the purposes of your year off of it?
Sure. And sugar is one of those terms that gets very confusing very quickly because it means lots of different things in lots of different contexts and to different people. Of course, there's, 56 some odd, we're still counting different names for sugar as an ingredient. And there's also, people talk about simple sugars, which are carbs, and blood sugar, which refers to your blood glucose level. But for our purposes, during our year, what we meant when we said no sugar was no added sugar. So, and very specifically, no fructose, no added fructose in our food. So, now, that might sound like not such a big deal, right? Oh, no added fructose, but it's everywhere.
And when you say no added, you mean no sugar sprinkled on your cereal, no honey in your oatmeal.
That's right.
Okay. Yes. And also no added sugar in processed foods.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
That was the bigger challenge, I would imagine.
I would say that's where it's hard logistically, just knowing the different names and reading, that tiny little type, I should have brought my magnifying glass with me and a dictionary to the store the first few times that I went, because I ended up spending about twice as much time as I used to spend shopping for groceries because I had a lot to learn.
On the other hand, some food processors are getting canny about things, and they're part of their labeling is no added sugar, no high fructose corn syrup.
Right. Well, that's the thing. One of the things that's come up is this this idea that high fructose corn syrup is much worse for you than other sugars. So-called natural sugars.
Right.
And so you'll see no high fructose corn syrup. But what I like to point out to people is that all sugars chemically are doing the same thing in your body, whether it's organic fruit juice or honey or molasses or maple syrup or table sugar or, yes, high fructose corn syrup. They're all doing the same thing. They're all going straight to your liver and creating toxic byproducts in your body.
Ugh.
Yeah,
yeah. Where you put that. This really straight to your liver. All right. My guest is Eve Schaub. She's the author of Year of No Sugar. If you have a question or comment for Eve, if you're trying to kick sugar, maybe she has some suggestions for you since she did it for a year. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why did you decide to do this, and why have your family join you?
Well, the inspiration for the project was after I had watched Dr. Robert Lustig's YouTube video. I just, by complete chance came across this video and watched it. It's about 90 minutes long, And I was absolutely captivated by his argument that sugar acts in our body as a toxin. And he goes through and correlates excessive sugar intake as a society, as our culture does. You know, we keep upping the sugar, and you know, we're trying to be healthier, we're trying to be better, and yet all these terrible health epidemics, which are modern health epidemics, have been increasing. You know, everything from obesity and metabolic syndrome and diabetes to heart disease and hypertension and liver disease and even cancer, all can be correlated to our excessive sugar intake. So that was enough to really freak me out. And after that, everywhere I went, you know, everywhere you go, there's food. Right. Mm-hmm. And everywhere in our culture that there's food, there's sugar. And it was as if I suddenly was seeing the world in a whole new way. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. What can I do? Yes, I want to feed my family differently. I want to think differently about the choices I make in my home. But what can I do that would be bigger than that? And that's how I got this idea.
And were they all really happy to go along with you in this project?
Oh, no.
Tell us, I mean, how many kids do you have?
I have two. Uh-huh. And at the time, they were 6 and 11.
Oh, my gosh.
And my husband, I'm endlessly impressed by the fact that he agreed to do this. I'm sure that there are not that many husbands out there who would say, yeah, that sounds great. Let's not eat sugar for a year. But he was like, well, that sounds interesting. Sure, why not? Let's try it. And sadly, the girls did not react that way. When we told them about the project, I write about it in the book. You know, we were driving home from a visit to my mom's house, and we were trying to break this to them gently. They saw right through that. They burst into tears as soon as they figured out what we were talking about. They knew this was going to affect their lives in untold different, you know, so many different ways everywhere they went. And of course, you know, I said, they were like, well, how long will this be for? And I said, well, just for a year. Now, to a 6-year-old, a year is forever.
Well, to me, it's forever. What are you talking about, a 6-year-old?
Yeah.
All we have is today.
That's right. That's right. So they saw through all my attempts to make this, you know, to sugarcoat it. Right? Yeah. To make it easier to grasp and be comfortable with. They knew that this was going to be uncomfortable upsetting at times.
Well, that's a good thing to say. I mean, was it uncomfortable? Did you go through a sort of withdrawal?
Well, because we didn't know how else to do it, we did go cold turkey. I mean, we just woke up on New Year's Day and started. You know, we didn't have a plan. We didn't taper off. We just started. And yeah, I think that there were, it sometimes is hard to differentiate between the biological cravings that you have and what I call the emotional cravings that you have. You know, it's hard to tell sometimes which thing is working in your brain at that moment. But I found that the biological cravings seemed to subside after not very long, like maybe 2 weeks. But the emotional cravings were harder, because that's the part of your brain that's telling you it's time to celebrate, it's time to mark this occasion, it's time to, you know, whatever, you know, you should reward yourself, you know, all these ideas we have in our head that have been there for a long time. You know, they're cultural things that we do. We mark occasions with sugar. We express love and affection with sugar. We cheer ourselves up when we're sad. We celebrate when we're happy.
We crawl home after work and have a bottle of wine. So what about wine?
Wine. Wine is an interesting one. A lot of people ask me about that. Wine is actually, I generally tell people, unless you are being just completely fanatical, like we were, you can have wine and really not worry about the fructose, because there is some, but it's an infinitesimal amount. Because all of that fructose in the fermentation process gets converted into alcohol. So, you know, you're trading one poison for the other.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's totally fine to have a glass of wine. I would not worry about that at all. I'd be worried about the glass of apple juice.
Omar and Lewis Center, you're on the air with author Eve Schaub. She wrote the book Year of No Sugar, and you've given up sugar. Welcome to the show, Omar.
Uh, thank you very much. I just want to commend your guest. I've really been off sugar since 2011 in May. Next month is going to be 3 years, and I'm loving it. A lot of people thought that I would never be able to do it, and it really was tough, I would say, the first 2-3 months, and after that it was absolutely fantastic, and I'm enjoying it. I have nothing that added sugar to it.
But, Omar, why did you decide to do that in the first place?
Well, I have a severe reaction to allergies, and I've been trying. Nothing works. Even, you know, a shot every week didn't work. And I was reading Dr. Furman, the connection between diet and allergies. And
Joel Furman?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to give it a shot, actually. It didn't work, actually. There was no connection between sugar and that. But I'm enjoying really being off sugar, and I think I will continue to be off sugar. The only sugar that I have is from fruits, which I don't really eat a lot. So.
Okay. Thanks, Omar.
Thank you.
That's terrific. I think that's, I congratulate him. That's wonderful.
Why, so were you surprised? Well, first of all, let me ask you this. Did you suspect that sugar was harming your family?
Well, I'd say, you know, a lot of people ask me if we lost weight. A lot of people ask if the kids, that's a good question. And the shorter answer is no, we didn't. And the reason for that is because that, luckily for us, wasn't a problem that we had. It wasn't something we were looking to solve. And by the same token, people often ask me if the kids were calmer when we stopped eating sugar. Mm-hmm. And again, hyperactivity is a big problem, but lucky for us, it wasn't a problem we had. It wasn't something we were looking to solve. Mm-hmm. Instead, I was looking at it from a much more long-term, you know, this is a long-term toxin. We might not, I write in the book, we might not even know. We might not see any obvious results because it's such a long-term thing. It's just like other toxins like cigarettes, for example. I like to compare it to cigarettes because, you know, you can have cigarettes today, tomorrow, next month, next year. You might not see the effects of that for decades, but when you do, they can be catastrophic, right? And every person's a little bit different in how that might play out. But I'm happy to say that we did find some very positive things that surprised me.
Like what?
I had more energy. We all did. We were healthier. I, in particular, have always battled having enough energy to get through my day. And I was one of those people who I'm sure they're targeting those five-hour energy drinks towards. You know, I really had struggled with that as long as I could remember. And when I wasn't eating added sugar in my food, I suddenly found that I had plenty of energy. So that was a terrific, unforeseen benefit.
Is there a chemical basis for this? Is there...
I don't understand.
Okay.
And I'm always quick to point out, I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. I don't come up from any medical background, and I'm not a nutritionist. So this is me simply, you know, I have a section in the book where I describe the argument, and I go through and I give all of the different correlations. But I have to preface it by saying this is me telling you the information that people who understand biochemistry way better than I ever will are saying, and I'm simply conveying it to you in the best way I possibly can. This is my, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a mom, understanding of it.
Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air with Eve Schaub. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. This old curmudgeon has to confess that he had a apple strudel at Einstein's this morning. I'm sorry. But Eshad, have you ever heard of the book Sugar Blues by William Duffy?
I have.
Duffy? Have you?
I have indeed, yes.
I read it probably 40 years ago.
Oh, boy, yeah.
It is a great book. And I would recommend it to anyone besides your book. And I commend you for going 365 days with no sugar. By the way, you addressed Ms. Fisher on wine. It's my understanding, Eshad, that scotch is virtually sugar-free. I've never been to Scotland, but I'd love to go and visit one of those distilleries and see how they do that. Is that correct?
Scotch, you know, I honestly, I'm not a scotch drinker, so I think
didn't
that's correct,
up.
But I'm not sure I'd be able to swear by it. I'd have to look a little further on that, but I would suspect it's true.
All right, Jerry, thanks a lot for your call. What about the sugar blues thing, though? Is that relating to behavior and mental illness or mental health and sugar?
Now, to be completely truthful, I have not read Sugar Blues.
Oh.
That's a book a lot of people come up to me and cite, saying that it came out, as he mentioned, a few decades ago, and that it was very influential for them. And I think that I definitely need to go and check that one out. I have read some more recent publications on the same topic, such as Dr. Robert Lustig's Fat Chance, which I highly recommend, as well as David Gillespie, the Australian author's book, Sweet Poison. Those are the two that I always point people towards if they want to know more about the biochemistry and how it all works in your body.
What meal was the hardest to achieve this goal with? Or was there not one?
Well, you know, I think it might be a tie between breakfast and snacks, you know, because those are both really tough times. Breakfast is tough between sugared cereals and baked goods. I mean, there's so many. It's a minefield, breakfast. And snacks, because, you know, people are always trying to have healthy snacks to get them through their afternoon. But so many things that we are sort of have this understanding that they're healthy for us, you know, flavored yogurts and granola bars and power bars and fruit juice. Again, you know, we have this idea that these are all very healthy things, but they can have as much sugar, if not more, as a candy bar.
Were you surprised to learn how many products contain added sugar? Even though
absolutely, I was. I knew I was going to find it, but even knowing that, I was still surprised. 3/4 of the items for sale in our supermarkets contain added sugar, added fructose. And I was just astounded to find sugar hiding in the weirdest places, things that aren't sweet at all.
Like what?
You know, like tortillas. Tortellini.
Flour tortillas?
Yes, yes. I know. I couldn't believe it either.
Well, I put a little bit of sugar in my pie crust.
Okay, yeah, but you know, what I ended up doing was I started making tortillas at home, which is a little bit of a pain, but they're really good when you do. And it's very simple. You know, it's basically flour and water, and it's like nothing. I mean, then and meanwhile, we have a little burrito place that's not too far away from us, and I went in there and I asked very politely, you know, if I could see the ingredients in their tortillas, because they buy them, and theirs did not have sugar. So I think it all depends. But I did find it in the ones at our supermarket, sadly, so I couldn't buy those. And bread is a big one, all the sandwich breads. You know, we have 250-some-odd different varieties at our supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
We found one that did not contain added sugar.
Was it any
we
good?
Looked at all of them.
Did it taste good?
Yeah, it was. It's good. It's good. And so when I don't have time to make my own bread at home, I know I can at least go. But I had to do that research, you know. So yeah. What I like to do is on my website, which is yearofnosugar.com, I have a little slideshow, a very short little slideshow with some of the products that we found worked really well for us during our year and since. You know, so, you know, if you don't have time to read the ingredients on all 250 different loaves of bread, you can just go to that one that we found.
So how did it change your life in a permanent way, or did it not?
It did, definitely did. I think that once we finished, a lot of people ask me, what now? What do you do now?
Mm-hmm.
And for us, you know, a lot of folks also expected us to sort of go on this crazy sugar, you know, cotton candy binge.
Right.
And we didn't have the inclination to do that. Even the kids. I mean, they were excited that it was going to be over. I have to tell you. Simply because it meant that we could ease up a little on being just so totally strict about everything. And they were excited because on New Year's Eve, we all got to have a little treat and everybody chose something different. You know, the kids picked these fancy little cookies and I had a piece of candy. I hadn't had a piece of candy in a whole year. So that, you know, and I had it and it was kind of anticlimactic. It was mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, I remember that, you know,
mm-hmm.
no big deal. Brushed my teeth and went to bed, you know. So after that, we didn't want to go back to where we had been before. We had to sort of figure out now what are the rules? Mm-hmm. How do we navigate without having this very clear-cut line? We have to find a new place to draw the line.
Right.
And where we are now is that we don't buy those products that have sugar in them.
Okay. Well, we are out of time, and I am sorry to say that. It would have been a lot of fun to get into this some more, you Shab. So maybe come back and talk about it some more.
I'd love to.
All right, Ishab, author of Year of No Sugar. Thanks for listening today on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.